This is CliffCentral.com.
It's time for the burning platform, and Gwen Gwenya is here. We've spoken to Gwen before. How are you, Gwen? Are you well?
Fantastic this morning. Thanks, Gary.
Good. It's nice to see you again. The last time we spoke to you, we talked about a whole bunch of things. There's so much more every other week. Justice isn't here today. He'll be back next week. But we thought, you know what? Another excuse to get you in. Why the hell not? So you've been paying attention to the news. First of all, what do you think of Pravin's medium-term budget speech, the little budget?
I mean, you've just had a really long session on that already. But I mean, I think he said the things that he needed or everyone was looking to hear from the minister. But I think some of us are still a bit disappointed on the things that were left out. For example, you know, this was a very sort of standard speech in terms of making sure that investor confidence, investors are sure that, you know, our fiscal expenditure is under control, etc. But there was very little talk about some of the promises that were made in February. For example, reforms in the state-owned entities. So he only touched on the sort of governance issues, saying that, you know, that appointed a board for SAA and that, you know, etc. And that the post office and Eskom
and SABC.
Exactly. But there wasn't much talk about the operational side, which I think is also, you know, what people look at and are very concerned about, is how these you know, agencies' operations are going. So I think that was left out. And then, of course, everyone's been mentioning structural reforms. I do realize this is not a budget speech, so it's perhaps not the time to make, you know, big sort of visionary statements, but I think South Africa needed some kind of direction as well from the minister, and not these really short-term outlooks. So I think our concern is just about the ratings agencies and only looking at South Africa and, well, what's happening in December, what's happening in the next 2 years. But I think we need to start looking a bit further out and thinking.
Well, I think that he's probably at the back of his mind, he's got this bugging him. Is that,
yes,
the revenues are getting smaller and smaller, and expenses are getting bigger and bigger.
Yes.
And that's not a good place to be. That's like living beyond your means on an individual
sense.
Yes,
but at the end of the day, I get the feeling from the budget, you know, that you're just taking from Peter to feed Paul, as, you know, that saying goes, and not really much is being said about how to grow the pie instead of just taking from one place and plugging it into another.
Well, maybe they just don't know how.
Well, I mean, they've suggested tax increases, which are not going to please everyone, but at least the consensus, or at least just the rumor, seems to be that it's unlikely to come from personal income tax. I mean, there's many other tax areas they're looking at. There's the obviously controversial sugar tax. There's the VDP that they announced earlier in the year.
What's that?
That's the voluntary disclosure program that SARS announced, basically allowing any companies, individuals with foreign assets and income who haven't yet declared them to do so. And I think that's a period in order to obviously avoid any kind of charges.
Oh, right.
And that's been opened up from now in October. I think it's until June 2017.
Well, that'll bring in some money.
Well, at least they're hoping that it will. We'll see. So it's that, and there's also the carbon tax that's being floated as well. So I think there are some areas they're trying to get extra revenues from without, you know, looking at VAT, and which is obviously also deeply unpopular, or raising income taxes.
I think a lot of politicians just don't know how business works. And even educated people and people who really do know how economies work aren't entirely sure how money's produced. Like, they don't understand the basics of supply and demand. And maybe that's why it's very difficult for them to put together cogent, sensible fiscal policy in terms of how you've got to balance this growth, taxation, welfare situation. It's very much more complicated than I think a lot of people understand.
Well, and because the majority of the public don't understand, I think that's also what pushes governments to make popular decisions, you know, things that people will understand. So people do understand when you increase taxes, value-added tax, because all that affects ultimately it's streamed, you know, gets
everyone,
trickles down to the consumer, and people feel it. So that's why they try to avoid those more obvious areas where people do hurt.
But is there, are we squeezing, for example, the middle class in South Africa to a point where they're just,
I think so, definitely. And as I was saying, that is why the lack of sort of indication about where we're headed in terms of structural reforms is quite disappointing. It seems that the age-old line seems to be, well, we need to get implementation right, but we've been saying that since forever. The problem is not the NDP, it's just implementation. I think they need to start singing a different tune now, or at least giving it more detail as to what exactly isn't going right and maybe what different tactics are we going to use in order to achieve the overall strategy. But there was very little in this midterm policy statement. But as I said, I think people expect that because that's what it is. It's a kind of, you know, stock-taking exercise. You know, you gave your main sort of vision in February, and now it's the time to say, well, where are we with those plans? Do we need to make changes in order to achieve the goals that we had set? I suppose it's not really a time to set, you know, new strategy and new vision. So we probably will hear more about that in February next year.
When Pravin was at SARS, he was very good at getting a lot of money out of people. I mean, he was good at shaking the average taxpayer to the point where he knew exactly how much you had and how much you were giving, and he would work out the difference. Tom Moyane is now in charge at SARS, and a lot of people are saying he's really part of Jacob Zuma's network of patronage in some way, shape, or form. They can't quantify it yet, but certainly he doesn't seem to be over the moon about, you know, these investigations that Sean Abrams is taking part in. He doesn't seem to be hugely supportive of Pravin Gordhan, the two of them. One wants to get rid of the other. Do you think that SARS is maybe not doing as good a job as it could to bring in tax revenues?
No, I mean, every reason, I mean, from at least what Pravin was saying from the policy statement was that revenue seemed to be rather, I think, a reflector of just the depressed economy and perhaps even people losing jobs, etc. Because there's actually... we've managed to do quite well in terms of the collection of corporate taxes. The revenue shortfall largely came from less personal income tax than was expected. So that's a cause for concern. But I think on the corporate side, they're doing quite a good job. And at least on the personal income tax, I haven't read anything that seems to suggest that it was a failure of revenue collection, but rather simply that I suppose people had fewer taxes to file than was originally expected.
Okay, there's lots of political stuff to talk about too, but I did notice that during the speech, the president was asleep. Is that because he's just exhausted from all those court cases that he's embroiled in?
I don't know. It's just really not acceptable. I mean, even Robert Mugabe at the best of times sometimes manages to stay awake. He, of course, falls asleep quite often too, but the man is at least, I'm sure, two decades older than
the president. So what's his excuse?
Exactly.
What do you think the best case scenario in this whole state capture investigation is, and what do you think the most dangerous scenario is?
Well, I suppose the best case scenario is that it's revealed publicly and that we can all see what the public protectors or the institution has come up with and that we all get to read it. I suppose that's the best case scenario. As far as the worst case is, if the DA's sort of... concerns that Mkhwebane is just another agent, you know, for the Gupta family, then we have great reason to be concerned that report is likely never to come to light, and probably more activities are likely to be hidden under the carpet.
That's
definitely concerning.
Yeah, and then we'll never really know the full extent of it unless an investigation, a full-scale investigation, is brought to
Or I suppose if there are any other whistleblowers, either from Fake Mentor, who have more to say and perhaps can shed more light without the report being, because I assume in order to compile the report, there would have been extensive interviews done. And I don't see why those people need a report to necessarily make it public knowledge what they know. They could just come forward, go to the media and tell them the exact same thing they've told the public protector or the former public protector.
And we're seeing one or two people in business coming forward, Sipho Pityana and people like that, who are saying, you know, to here and no further.
Yes.
Declaring for a side.
I suppose rather late than never, but I'm really not one to pat the likes of Sipho Pityana or, you know, Trevor Manuel on the back for suddenly now growing some backbone. It's been a long time coming. I mean, as I said, better late than never.
Yeah.
But I think we have to wonder why now. They probably feel it's now safe to do so. Political allegiances have shifted enough for them to start probably hedging their bets for the next election. And it's all just about maneuvering and, you know, people securing favor with the next crowd that's likely to be in charge.
How about the Fees Must Fall movement? Where are we at there? I mean, you've also been watching that closely.
I'd gained a bit of confidence last week, or sort of early, late last week, when the Vice Chancellor Wits had said that he's now doing away with the curfew, because the whole weekend there had been sort of, was quite silent and no protest activity. Well, he spoke a bit too soon. I think it was Monday or Tuesday morning with a bus, that Wits bus was then set alight with apparently 15 students still inside.
Wow.
Just absolutely shocking. So I think just when you think things might starting to cool down, something flares up again. So I'm not sure. I'm not very hopeful anymore. There seems to be no end in sight. Also, the fake outrage, I was watching another video of these students hoarded on top of a police van. And of course, the van's kind of moving slowly, but then all of a sudden it grinds to a halt. And science, which they don't believe in, the law of inertia forces the one student colliding onto the pavement, because what happens when you're in a car and it suddenly stops, fly forward,
So they were
so
outraged.
So he smashes into the ground, obviously, and he's, he's lying there, but obviously it's quite a big one of, I don't know what they're called, those big police kind of look like army tanks, but it's written, they're not army ones.
Either a Casper or Nyana.
Yes, exactly.
Things,
So he then starts driving again. I mean, I assume either the police don't know that he hasn't moved out of the way, or maybe they do and they're just angry. But of course, then the crowd starts screaming because he's now about to be run over by this massive vehicle. I mean, then the video cuts there, but the comment section is kind of, this demonstrates the violence of the police. But my initial thought is, what were they doing on top of the police vehicle in the first place? I mean, it's kind of this, provoked outrage where I come and slap you, and then as soon as you're about to retaliate, somebody takes a video and it's like, terrible Gareth, how could he, retaliate against Gwen? But I mean, I've just slapped you. So yes, it's terribly frustrating. I think a lot of them are getting, their just desserts, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm always curious to see what this must look like to students on the inside who aren't particularly interested in politics, and students who aren't really motivated to do anything but get their degree.
Yes.
Like in the science department, or the engineering department, or any of those departments where they're not particularly... It's always the BA students who are up in arms, right? Because they've got nothing really to do. Their course isn't a very serious one. Most of the time they're studying poetry and bullshit. So they get out there.
Well, I think that's why. They spend their lives, reading about Marx and the revolution, and they start to see the real world as, like, this is now the tangible manifestation of what they only used to have in their textbooks. And... science students, what's in their textbooks is real. You actually get to fiddle with the Bunsen burner and pour around chemicals. Political students almost never actually get a taste of political life. So I think for them, this is, the theory manifests in real life, basically.
There might also be one other thing that we need to address here, and that is that a lot of these students have grown up without any real meaningful struggle. Like, their parents took part in a real struggle.
Exactly.
Right? And there's struggle envy. It's like, how do I fit into the world?
Yes.
What's my
thing? Envy and nostalgia, exactly.
Yeah. So if I want to matter in the world, I have to do what the previous generation did. But who am I going to fight against? Max Price at fucking UCT?
Yes. They imagine themselves so incredibly oppressed. And, they think the scenario is quite unique, but...
And they forget they're among the top 3% of the world's, of the country's population.
Exactly.
Who are actually privileged enough to go to university.
Exactly.
Regardless of what you can afford.
And there's no sort of comparative analysis that goes on. I mean, in the UK in 2010, they had student protests there. The police response was absolutely brutal. I mean, at least in numbers, at least at every one of those protests, you'd get, 2,000, thousands of police officers. They were sort of kettle the crowd. I think this the method called kettling, where they surround the crowd and ensure that they're enclosed to one area. So if they're in one street of, in town, they would kind of come from both ends, thousand strong groups of police officers, and just block them, and they would not be able to move for hours on end. But I think it's just the sheer force and perhaps organization of the police in the UK. I'm not sure if we would be able to deploy that many bodies on the ground to do that kind of thing.
I also don't know that our police know how to deal with civil protests.
Well, I'm a lot more sympathetic towards them, because I think when you have the numbers, you can control a crowd without becoming too physical and too violent. As I say, if you have a group of 50 protesters, or let's say even 100 or 200 protesters, but you at least have a 2,000 strong police presence, then of course they can contain them. But when the number of police officers match the number of students, I think sometimes it becomes difficult to contain the crowd without being violent, without making use of rubber bullets, which, by the way, have always been, they're very creation was as sort of riot weapons. So I'm not sure why there's this narrative in South Africa that they represent an absolute, excessive or use of force.
No, but everything to the left, everything is violence.
Yes,
that's words true.
Words are violent. Yes. So rubber bullets are.
you're dealing with a moronic ideology. All right, let's talk quickly about a very important thing that's going to be happening. The New Age newspaper is holding another one of its breakfasts. And this time they have the following people, and maybe you can comment on one or two of them as credible people to comment on the goings-on in society at the moment. There's James Aguma, Hladi Motsoeneng, Dr. Aaron Chidzumba, and Mzwanele Manyi, as well as Andile Mkitama. Would you go to this breakfast?
I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with propaganda as long as you know that it's propaganda. So,
yeah.
Yes, it's a heavily, one-sided debate or discussion that will be, quite clearly.
Sounds great. I mean, I can't wait for my invitation. It's going to be terrific. That's on Morning Live on SABC.
You're quite optimistic that you'll receive one.
Oh, sure. I don't know why they wouldn't have me on the panel. I fit with all those people. All right, Gwen, thank you very, very much. As always, interesting to talk to you about the stuff that's going on in the world. Justice will be back next week, but we really appreciate you standing in for him this morning on The Burning Platform.
Thank you.
Very
great
cool.
To be here.
The Burning Platform every Thursday is brought to you by Nando's.
This is CliffCentral.com.